Hello, welcome to Wheat from the Chaff. I'm Finlo Costain, the editor-in-chief of 8.9.com.
And I'm Phil Carson, the UK head of policy for the Nature Friendly Farming Network.
And later in this programme, we're going to be joined by our guest, Rachel Jones from Sustain, who's been tasked with writing their growth plan for local food. So I'm looking forward to that. And then later on, we're going to be discussing the role of national parks and how to balance the need between trying to maintain the unique character of that landscape while also ensuring a living and farming landscape. But first off, we're going to talk about what's been happening in Scotland. Scotland's First Minister, Hamza Yousaf, has confirmed that 70% of future farm payments will come in the form of direct payments. And the way that the National Farmers Union of Scotland have been presenting this, it sounds like a big win, but actually I think it's pretty much what the government have been planning over the course of the last year or two. The only difference is that they've now confirmed that it's actually 70% of this funding that's going to come in the form of direct payments, but it will be on condition of greening.
Yes, you're right. This is confirming what has been, I suppose, in the pipeline and expected for quite some time, that there would be a large portion of future agricultural support in Scotland going to area-based support. So Scotland's agriculture policy is split into four different tiers, and tiers one and two are area-based with, I suppose, increased conditions from what you would have previously had under the basic payment scheme. And then tiers three and four are elective kind of voluntary actions, of which there would be support for delivering more ambitious land management actions, but also support to make changes within the supply chain and other things within that as well. So it has been claimed as a win, but it's very much, as you say, confirming plans that had already been made.
And although you say it's on the acreage payment, which acreage-based payment, which is essentially what there is at the moment, it is on condition of there being a whole farm plan. And that whole farm plan is requiring a whole range of different things, you know, from business plan to an equality duty declaration, which includes opportunities for women, climate, environmental and nature declaration, land management plans, carbon, soil and biodiversity audit declaration. So there's a whole range of things in there, even at the basic level. And so what one would hope, and obviously it depends, the devil of these things, as they say, is always in the detail and how ambitious the Scottish Government wants to be. But even within the basic tier one payments, there are greening conditions. And then as you go into tier two, which is the enhanced level direct payment, again, those expectations are increased. It goes a step further than the conditional measures and requires additional measures to deliver outcomes relating to efficiencies and reducing greenhouse gas emissions and delivering nature restoration. And as you say, that tier three is an elective payment for those who are prepared to go into really quite targeted measures around nature restoration.
And I think this points to one of the major challenges that policymakers across the UK are facing in developing their own bespoke methods of farm support post common agriculture policy. In England, for example, you have specific standards, specific actions that you apply for, and you agree to undertake those over a period of time. Whereas in Scotland and Wales, to a large extent as well, there is an area-based payment with conditions attached to those. Whether those conditions will be ambitious enough and will enable the right level of action for Scotland to deliver its quite ambitious climate commitments and also its emerging nature commitments as well is to be seen. And I suppose from my perspective, you view these conditions to area-based support with a bit of caution, based on the fact that in some cases they have been tried before and haven't really delivered all that much. So it'll be interesting to see where this goes over time. And I think one of the things within this as well is this takes us up to 2028. Where does the Scottish Government intend to move beyond that as well? Is there a transition beyond that where, say, 50% of funding or 60, 70% will be actually on those more ambitious voluntary measures? Or do they anticipate maintaining a large degree of area-based support going on in the future?
There are a number of things here that make me feel quite hopeful about it. I mean, the first is that they've talked not just about sustainable agriculture, but at that top level, in the title of these various documents coming out of government, we've seen the word regenerative. So it's not just about sustaining the status quo, but about delivering improvements. And they've also used the word outcomes. And it remains to be seen the degree to which the word outcomes is actually translated into genuine outcomes. And to give an example of that, some people would think of sticking in new hedgerows, having new miles of hedgerows as being an outcome, where it isn't, it's an input. And so whether government is understanding outcomes as being the thing that is delivered as a result of that positive hedgerow delivery, so for example, an increase in improved water management, an increase in the amount of biodiversity, the number of birds or butterflies or whatever you might expect to see as a result of that hedgerow, or whether they are really just simply measuring the inputs, because those are easy to measure in terms of accounting. But I mean, overall, I would see this as a good result. I've always said that public goods is a good way of looking at agriculture, but at the same time, I would have liked to have seen the English system delivered on a whole farm basis, that there is a need for there to be an ongoing level of payments that's sort of based on the size of farm, because all farms, no matter how big or small they are, can deliver improvements for nature. And so the fact that we've got these different tiers delivering different levels of protection for nature, different levels of ambition for regeneration, seems pretty good to me. You're not going to be able to survive simply on tier one payments. And so there is going to be a need to deliver that expectation in tier two. And if you're going to get a substantial uplift in funding, then you need to be looking at what you can do in tier three.
I would probably view this on the other side of the coin. I'm dubious that the tier two measures will amount to significant change in buying the change that's required to kind of put agriculture on this kind of sustainable regenerative path that they speak about. And I would say that the likelihood of focusing on outcomes is probably going to be focusing on the inputs that are expected to deliver those outcomes as well. I imagine that's probably the focus that will be directed to within this. I think we've had over 20, 25 years of area-based payments, which have tried to evolve to bring in more conditions from an environmental perspective. And ultimately, we haven't really seen that trajectory kind of addressing some of those declines environmentally, from biodiversity, climate, all those sorts of things. I think we need a new approach. I think it needs to be managed well and have a transition towards that. And I think if this was to be the starting block towards something different over time, and that was clearly communicated, you could see the rationale behind that. But being cynical about it is mirroring largely what's happening on with the common agriculture policy at the moment, with area-based payments and eco-schemes and then agri-environment schemes over the top of it. And again, the assessments on that front seem to suggest that means they are not going to deliver their commitments from a nature, climate, food security perspective in many ways. So I am viewing it with a bit of scepticism on first reading.
A bit of scepticism is good. I watching the development of this over the course of time, I've seen the language strengthen, and that's something that I think is welcome. And of course, now we have a different system in England. We're likely to see different systems in Wales and Scotland. So we'll be able to see, we'll come back in a couple of years' time and see whether we think that they've really understood the notion of outcome and whether they started to deliver. I'm hopeful, you're sceptical, and somewhere in the middle, we'll have to see what happens. And there's no doubt, you know, I used to live in Scotland, and there is some fantastic farming going on in Scotland, but there's also some really poor farming in places as well. And the challenge will be to see whether it pulls up that poor farming where it exists without diminishing the exceptional farming that's going on in the places where that's already happening. Shall we move on to number two, which is survey reveals bleak relations between landlords and tenant farmers. And this, Phil, seems to me to be an enormous problem, really, looking forward particularly to the future. It's a problem now, but looking into the future. And here we've got the Tenant Farmers Association that have published the results of a survey of tenant farmers, painting a bleak picture, they say, of the relationships between landlords and tenants within the agricultural sector. They're saying that 30% of tenant farmers feel bullied or harassed by their landlords, and that rises to 37% when land agents are included in that. 40% of them feel ignored, and 70% of them just don't meet the landlord regularly at all to discuss what's happening on that land. Now, that sounds to me like an issue.
Yeah, this is very concerning, and you read the headline and it says bleak, and then you read the detail and you're wondering whether bleak is...
It's bleaker.
is actually strong enough. And yeah, there's suppose details in terms of harassment, in terms of bullying, I suppose really feeling that lack of power to negotiate with their landlords. It's quite significant. And I suppose the piece does acknowledge that it's a relatively small sample size and that it might be potentially those that feel most aggrieved that, for example, are responding. But even so, this is, yeah, as you say, very, very concerning. And in particular, I suppose the TFA, so Tenant Farmers Association, there's George Dunn, makes the point that there's a long way to go before tenant farmers feel that they're being treated fairly, reasonably, and most importantly, with respect as well. And this follows on from, I suppose, the ROC review, which looked into tenancy in the round and provided a range of different recommendations to create a better, more, I suppose, fair tenant sector within England. And yeah, I suppose the point is that there's a long way to go before we start to see, yeah, a general improvement in things. I suppose the big question is where do we go next after this?
And that word that you use, respect, I think that's really crucial in this. And I'd use the word compassion. I think there needs to be respect and compassion from both a tenant perspective and a landlord perspective in order to make those relationships work. And I know that the government is looking into how it can improve tenant-landlord relationships in the housing sector and how it can improve the rights of tenants. And it strikes me that they really need to do some focusing on the farming tenanted sector as well. And I think in the future, I mean, as I said, this is important now because there are so many broken relationships out there. But in the future, this is going to become more important as the ecological emergency hits home, as we potentially see more people trying to produce food locally, we potentially start seeing a bit of an exodus from urban areas and back into rural areas. And so we really need to enable people to have access to farm land in order to be able to produce their food. It's important in terms of new entrants and innovation, creating new ideas, allowing diversity into agriculture. But there also needs to be, rather than just, you know, having that current tenant model where there's a whole load of acres that are given over to a tenancy, perhaps there are ways that farmers today might look at how they can rent out an acre or just a few acres, whether that's into, you know, allotment type relationships or to a cooperative or to communities, so that, you know, the village is able to lease 5 acres of a farmer's land and then manage that relationship to other people living in that village so that they're able to grow their own food or grow food to feed into smaller supply chains.
Couldn't agree more. I think there's a need to fix the current system and make sure that works for those who are currently tenants and try and repair that relationship, and also to look at the role that, yeah, I suppose a more creative and imaginative approach to tenancy in the round could play in delivering a lot of, I suppose, government's objectives, but also in delivering, yeah, I suppose, yeah, society's objectives as well, and helping people connect more with the land and relocalising supply chains, all the things that you've spoken about. Yeah, be bold, be brave, be ambitious with this sort of stuff. But to get there requires sorting out the very real problems that seem to be on the table at this point in time.
I mean, one of the keys seems to me to be that sort of cooperative model of ownership, cooperative model of managing things, whether it's a small abattoir or whether it's land or whether it's individual businesses as we move forward, and to create that vibrancy and diversity, not just in rural areas, but in countryside economies as well. Next story, Phil.
Yes, the next piece is around the hidden record of UK's historic biodiversity and how that will be digitised. So there's a historic collection of more than 10,000 dried and pressed specimens, which dates back more than 200 years, and it's actually going to be digitised and recorded in a time capsule record of biodiversity in the UK. And this is being undertaken by the Royal Agricultural University, or the RAU, and it has all of these records in a delicate paper format, but it's now going to be digitally photographed, recorded and catalogued by staff, students and volunteers at the university with some funding in order to do that. So this collection covers or comprises of over 10,000 plant specimens on 4,000 sheets. So it's quite a considerable piece of work trying to digitise all of these. And it ranges back from the 1820s all the way through to 1970. And I think this deep dive into history, it's hoped that this will be very useful in terms of informing future land management, assessing the impact of climate change, all sorts of different things like that. So it'll be very, very useful in a current context as well. So just really, really interesting piece of work, which should be quite insightful and important in determining actions in the future as well.
And what they're saying, of course, is that currently, if you're trying to find commonalities or themes or trends within them, then you're having to sort through these bits of paper, which, first of all, is very difficult. But as these bits of paper are old and the seeds and plants on them are very delicate, that's obviously not something that people can do on a regular basis. And so until it's digitized and that metadata from the different records is collected, there isn't any other way really than sort of working through this. So they're hoping that this is going to be a rich seam of data that's unlocking this hidden natural heritage. And later in the week, I'll be speaking to Dr. Kelly Hemmings, who's running this project at the RAU, and that TV interview will be out later in the week. Now, the next story is about a UK-wide exhibition, which is spotlighting food producers. And this is coordinated by the Gaia Foundation, and it's called We Feed the UK. It brings together over 40 partners for the environment and the art sectors. The series tells 10 time-critical stories across urban, rural and coastal areas, ranging from multi-generational, black-led growing projects in London to majority women workers cooperative in Edinburgh via, it says, sustainable fishing along the south coast. The thing that I was interested in here, Phil, I mean, quite apart from the fact that the photography in this exhibition looks fantastic and some fantastic poems, there's a trailer from the Hot Poets, part of the We Feed the UK exhibition, which is already on 8.9. And if you sort of go to the 8.9 TV bit, you can find the trailer. And it's just 2 minutes of collated lines of poetry making, as it were, a new poem.
That trailer is brilliant and I think really shows the importance of engaging with the arts and I suppose looking at land through a different lens and communicate that in a way which farmers or policymakers probably couldn't do justice to in some ways. It was just brilliant. And yeah, I watched the trailer and the opening line, it's sumptuous feckin' soil sends a charge of good energy through the soles of a brown-skinned barefoot baby learning that dirt is not just dirt. And I was like, wow, that is brilliant. It's so evocative and really, really fascinating and inspirational. Amazing. Project.
And there was another one in there. I'm not quoting it, but it was about a child picking a tomato that didn't have a barcode on it for the first time, which I thought was fantastic. And the thing I wanted to ask you about, Phil, was about the role of the arts, of culture, in helping to change attitudes towards farming and towards, you know, these sorts of things more generally.
Hugely important and can just bring a different perspective on things which really resonates with people. We spoke about this a couple of podcasts ago, I think. We can dole out or spurt out all of the data and statistics that we want and people's eyes will glaze over. And then if you manage to put something forward in a way which is creative, which makes people feel something, it's so much more compelling and can generate a far greater sense of understanding within that as well. And I think this project is all about that. It's about moving people emotionally to understand and engage with a subject which is crucially important, but quite often is overlooked.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, this sort of thing, it just really helps farmers to see what the public values, because these are, you know, these are poems and photographs that have been taken by members of the public who aren't farmers themselves. What is it that they're interested in? It allows them to make that connection. And of course, it helps the public to feel more connected with the food and the farmers and where our food comes from, how the land is used, to get a better understanding of these things. And if we're looking at the way that land needs to change in the future to meet the needs of repairing the climate emergency, the nature emergency, at the same time as continuing to produce food and producing fibre and integrating forestry in there, then having this sort of broad understanding that probably only arts and culture can bring is phenomenally important. Phil, what's the last story before we go to a break?
Yes, the last story is entitled Traceability Markers to Deliver Transparency in Recycled Cotton Supply Chain. This is a pretty fascinating piece of work. And I suppose the press release, which is on the website, really emphasizes the fact that we have large quantities of textile waste on an annual basis. So within the EU, there's 5.8 million tons per year, equating to over 11 kilograms per person of textile waste every single year. And this is increasingly becoming a problem from an environmental perspective in terms of how we deal with this waste. Just the fact that there's, I suppose, a culture of waste in the first place, and regulators are starting to step up and try and look at solutions to try and address the waste, but also turn waste streams into value. So there's new regulation coming down the track, and there's a need within that to adapt to that, and looking at ways to produce and also recycle textiles in a way which I suppose is regenerative. So this piece in particular focuses on how that can be, I suppose, measured and audited. And it's a piece of work from Circular Systems. It's a company called Circular Systems who joined forces with Fibertrace. And what they're doing is implementing physical traceability technologies into their recycled cotton. And it's really, really fascinating within this. So it actually allows for traceability markers to be suspended in the fibres themselves, to be able to demonstrate to, I suppose, the supply chain key information about how they were produced as well, to try and build up, I suppose, the credibility and the traceability of that as well. So really, really fascinating piece of work within this, and yeah, quite innovative stuff going on. Don't know what you thought about it yourself.
Well, I think it's astonishing, isn't it? It's the idea that there's a watermark. It's almost like you can put trace elements into these threads in the same way that you might in a banknote, but this can provide information to provide, as you say, that audit trail throughout the supply chain, so that, you know, when it's marketed and sold as recycled in the marketplace, there is a guarantee for the customer and for the retailers that are selling that it's come from recycled sources, and it can be traced right back to the origin of where that recycling took place. Fantastic, beautifully done. Let's take a break. And we're back, and we're joined by Rachel Jones from Sustain. Thanks so much for being with us, Rachel. Now, last week, social media was buzzing with frustration following clips from a Channel 4 News interview with Hannah Ritchie from Our World in Data. And you've written a blog on the Sustain website about this. It was sort of expressing a degree of frustration, but really it was an opportunity to talk about local food systems, what they look like, what they are, and how important they are. So perhaps we can just start off by saying, what was it that annoyed you about the interview with Channel 4 News?
Yeah, I'm not sure that it annoyed me so much as I sort of felt like the interview went out last week demanded a response. And that was largely because I think the comments that were made in combination with how Channel 4 presented them sort of resulted in quite a strong oversimplification of food sustainability. And I think the point Hannah was making was not wrong at all. You know, she was pointing out that actually the transport emissions, the carbon footprint of a product of food, make up a very small proportion of the overall GHG impact. Sort of the majority of the emissions come from land use and on-farm activities rather than the transport emissions itself. But I think the challenge I had with that was, while all that is true, there was then a massive leap made from saying that actually transport emissions are a very small part of GHG emissions to local food sustainability being a big myth. And that was the term used. And that was the clip that was pulled out by Channel 4 and sort of circulated around. And it sort of felt to me like, actually, that argument takes a very narrow view of what food sustainability is. Even on the, if we just purely look at the environmental side, impact is not greenhouse gas emissions alone. We know that we need to consider much more than that: water, nature, everything else. But actually, sustainability needs to be much more intersectional than that in general. So we need to be looking at social factors, at equality, at food security, at economic factors as well. And so we need to have a much broader debate about what a sustainable food system looks like than simply greenhouse gases and simply, you know, transport emissions being the only thing that local food can offer. And I just wanted to say, sort of in response, this isn't about global versus local from my perspective at all. There is a place for both, and we need both if we're going to make the transition to a sustainable food system that we really need, while maintaining supply and supporting the economies around the world that sort of need it the most. And I'm a really big fan of growing communities' food zones model. I don't know if you've seen that, but it's a sort of a model that lays out what it makes sense to source locally, what it makes sense to source from sort of further and further afield, looking sort of regionally, nationally, to Europe and beyond. And it's actually a mix of these different things that we need if we're going to have sort of sustainable, fair and secure food systems.
Absolutely. It's slightly frustrating, isn't it, when even kind of mainstream, reputable news outlets like Channel 4 do this kind of Piers Morgan thing of kind of pulling out the most controversial element and something which is necessarily simplistic, because, of course, it does polarise the debate. And then it inspires an opportunity for us to have this conversation, but we're not being listened to by as many people as Channel 4 News. And so, you know, while we can try and push back a little bit on that polarisation, it really doesn't help things. And I wonder, you know, you started outlining there some of the elements of a local food system, and you're there to write the growth plan for local food, for sustain. What sort of things are you going to be looking at?
Yeah, so this is a project that's being done in collaboration with Sustain and a load of other organisations, including the Land Workers Alliance, the FFCC, and other partners as well. And essentially what we're looking at is we wanted to set like a big ambitious goal, and that currently stands at, we want to grow the local food sector by 10% by 2030. And we're looking at how that might be possible. This involves sort of looking, taking sort of several principles that we're adopting to sort of look at this. So we are looking at kind of the system as a whole. So everything from farm level to the infrastructure we need to grow the local food sector, to what happens in the retail sector, to procurement, as well as on the demand side as well. So what do we have to do with eaters, the people that, you know, the food is reaching as well, in order to grow the size of the sector. So we're drawing on work that's been done before. This is not about reinventing the wheel. We know lots of people are already looking at different parts of this. So it's sort of bringing together everything we already know, sort of aggregating it into one place. And we want to do this in a really collaborative way. So bringing together actors along the supply chain to look at what are the barriers you're facing? What are the solutions you really think we need? But then also working with what we're calling enablers. So people that have the power to make change on these issues, be those government departments, local authorities, investors, researchers, SFPs. What is the contribution that they can make from what's being asked from those supply chain actors? And then we really want to produce a set of recommendations out the back of this that look, obviously there are a million different things that could be done to grow the local food sector, but actually where strategically does it make the most sense for us to put our effort, our investment, and our advocacy time? So we're hoping to produce a sort of really clear, concise set of recommendations that we then turn into action plans for the people that have the power to make change on these issues as well. And then we're going to use this to help, try and shape policy and advocacy, direct investment to where it's most needed.
Amazing. That sounds great. Thank you. I just had a question around the supply chain, and obviously this work and this conversation is taking place at a time when, there's quite a lot of farmer frustration out there. We've obviously seen, we discussed last week, protests within Europe, and also the focus in the UK seems to be more on the supply chain rather than government or government schemes. So how crucial is kind of supply chain fairness within the journey towards local food?
I mean, it's absolutely critical. One of the biggest barriers that we're facing, I think, when it comes to growing the local food sector is supply, lack of supply. And actually, we know from the recent work that Riverford have done, farmers are under real strain financially. And, you know, that's from the Riverford campaign. We know that's about the behaviour of the supermarkets. But actually, if we don't manage to get fairness in the supply chain, fair pay, fair conditions for the producers, we're not going to have the supply to grow the local food sector at all. So this is absolutely critical. And I work very closely with my colleague Will White, who is the Sustainable Farming Coordinator at Sustain, who has been quite involved with this Riverford campaign. And they've really been calling for stronger regulation on retailers by government. So actually, the grocery code adjudicator needs much stronger powers to enforce the grocery supply code of practice. At the moment, they're very small, they don't have very many powers to actually do any enforcement. And also, it needs to be expanded to cover intermediaries, not just retailers as well. And Will is also doing a lot of work on, for example, helping to de-risk the move towards agroecological farming through sort of just transition methods, and advocating for that as well. Because farmers, I think, without support aren't going to be able to, they shouldn't be shouldering the burden for this transition alone. There should be support in the form of training, subsidies, payments for this kind of work. So Will is working sort of very much on that. And, you know, we haven't finished the local food growth plan yet, but what I imagine will come out of this is that we also need government to support the growth of the local food sector, not just for reasons of food security, although that is very important, but also because local food systems do provide opportunities for alternative ways of trading that are fairer to the producers and fairer to the other sort of processors and supply chain actors along the way.
One of the things we've been discussing today, so the piece that was just on before you came in, was around that connection with people and the public and being able to communicate the importance of food and farming in delivering so many different things. Often there's a bit of a divide between how urban people, I suppose, and country folks, so to speak, kind of view land use and food production and everything as well. And is there a need to kind of bridge that gap in a move to local food as well, if that makes sense?
And can I just sort of jump in and say, it's not just a divide between urban and country folk, you know, sort of living in the countryside. I am so surprised so frequently by the distance that exists between people who live in the countryside and the farmers who farm the fields literally behind them.
I think this is a major issue, isn't it, in general? And I think, I mean, to my mind, there's a lot of different approaches that we could take that probably all need to be considered. I think with the local food growth plan, the one thing that we're hoping to do is we're really inspired by citizens' assemblies and the bringing together of people from a real diversity of backgrounds to try and crack some of these problems together and breed consensus and sort of setting the scene for an environment of understanding and negotiation. I think one really fantastic example of this was the Citizens' Assembly on Climate Change that was done a few years ago. And there's a fantastic documentary on the BBC that sort of outlines how that process happened and how actually they brought together such a diversity of people with different perspectives, but managed to come out with a plan, which I think was that everyone was sort of bought into and happy with. I think it's really inspiring. One thing we talk about a lot when we're talking about local food systems is food hubs. So the idea of actually there being, I guess it's a wholesaler distribution, sort of ethical wholesaler distribution type setup where lots of different farms can feed into a food hub. And it sort of, you know, it optimizes the system for efficiency and economies of scale. And actually that's a real connection between the urban and the rural as well, because that is a physical place where, you know, you're bringing the two together. You know, it connects sort of the retailers in the urban areas. Better Food Shed in Dagenham is a really good example of that. But actually, how could we maximize the use of food hubs for sort of, you know, creating a sort of more sort of common shared understanding?
And in terms of that food hub that you just mentioned in Dagenham, is that something which is privately owned or cooperatively owned, or is it sort of run by the council?
No, it's actually run by Growing Communities, to reference them again. It was something that was established. They've had very little, tiny, tiny amounts of support from the local authority in Dagenham, but really it's been set up by Growing Communities, I think with some funding from a few sort of different funders, and it's sort of meant to be a demonstration project. But that's one thing we're going to be looking at sustain much more, particularly out the back of this local food growth plan. Because I know there's lots of sustainable food partnerships that would love a food hub and are struggling to get funding for it. So we're going to be looking at how do we actually accelerate the establishment of food hubs for SFPs that want them.
Rachel, could I ask you to define what you mean by growth? Because when we talk about growth, if we're thinking about growth in the local economy, then most people will be thinking about money. We tend to think in terms of, you know, growth and GDP. Is that what you mean? Is it just about money, or is it about sort of redefining what we mean by growth to include things like well-being and other elements as well?
Can I come in on top of that as well? Also defining what do we mean by local food as well?
Yes.
How important is that within this too?
Absolutely. I think that's a critical point. So lots of people mean different things by local food. At Sustain and within the Local Food Growth Plan project, our definition of local food involves the following three things. Short supply chains. So those are supply chains that have few or no intermediaries. They'll typically be regional in nature, but actually that can vary according to the different food types and where you are in the country as well. So it's currently impossible to do plant protein locally because there just isn't the demand locally. So we have to think wider than that. But with horticulture, locally means, you know, a much, much sort of tighter area than that. So it's short supply chains, independent retail, so food that goes through a variety of different retail outlets, not just the supermarkets. That could include box schemes, markets, independent shops, convenience stores, et cetera, et cetera. But it also, critically, the third point is it means local benefits. So truly local food must deliver benefits to the local producers, environments, communities, economies, and eaters that it passes through.
And just finally on growth.
Yes, on growth. I think what we mean is growth of the local food sector. And the local food sector, as far as I can see, the projects that we see around the country do not have money as the only metric of success. Yes, they have to be financially stable. They want to succeed, but actually they're much more about other metrics of success as well. Community cohesion, environment, fair pay to farmers, all of that sort of stuff. And I think we need to recognize that this sector is currently very small. If we want to change the food system, we do need to get bigger. That doesn't mean any one individual business has to grow, but actually as a sector, we have to get bigger. We have to be stealing market share. We have to be, you know, bringing in more customers and people if we want to actually change things.
I was always struck by the Hobnadod's version of growth. That Josiah Meldrum, when I spoke to him as part of a Farmgate podcast, he wanted to see the type of business that he had growing, but he didn't want to be growing himself beyond what he could manage. He wanted it to be growth by replication rather than simply growth by expansion.
Exactly. And I think that's totally a fine way to approach it. It doesn't, you know, there's no pressure on any one individual business to grow, but together we need to grow as a sector.
Fantastic. Rachel Jones from Sustain, thanks so much for joining us.
Let's
take a break. And we're back, and thanks once again to Rachel for coming in. That was really interesting to hear how Sustain is approaching the idea of growth in local food. Now, we're moving on to national parks, and we have a headline here. Ken Gorm's awarded $10.7 million to become the first net zero UK national park. And as a result of this, and as a result of the fact that there is a call for applications from different parts of the UK to be the next UK national park or a new national park for the UK, there seems to have been rising disquiet in farming circles on social media channels, complaints about national park authorities, overzealous councils applying rules in different ways in different parts of the country. And so stepping into this conversation, we then have the Food, Farming and Countryside Commission. And we've got an article that we've reproduced on the 8point9.com website, which is saying national parks must work for everyone. So it's about making sure that we are able to respect that unique national character at the same time as recognising that these are working landscapes and that farming for food, fibre and forestry is incredibly important, whether that takes place in a national park or outside. So just looking at the Cairngorms story briefly to begin with, the National Lottery Heritage Fund has awarded $10.7 million to the Cairngorms National Park Authority to deliver Cairngorms 2030, a programme to inspire people and communities in the national park to take action and to tackle the nature and climate crisis. And the programme's bringing together 20 long-term projects on nature restoration, active travel and sustainable transport, a whole range of different things, and they aim to help the Cairngorms become the UK's first net zero park. And looking at some of the things that they're trying to deliver, I tried to prioritise them. I tried to sort of break it down to two or three, and actually it's really difficult. There's some really good stuff they're talking about. So obviously, the first place to become net zero, a lot of new woodland, the equivalent of 1,500 football pitches, the world's first outdoor dementia resource centre, looking at transforming the way that people get around the Cairngorms, pioneering nature-friendly farming and green finance, fostering meaningful relationships with underrepresented communities, making sure that people who don't naturally gravitate towards the countryside start to enjoy the benefits of the countryside, and restoring 6,500 of carbon-storing peatland. And the final thing I'm just going to mention here is prescribing nature on the NHS. Phil, maybe I can come to you and perhaps you could set out what the problem is. Why is it that national parks are challenging for farmers who live inside them?
I think there's many things within that, and some I think are tangible challenges and others are around the potential or perceived impact of a designation, so to speak, as well, just in terms of the restrictions that could be placed on how the land is managed. We look at it, I suppose, in terms of national parks and planning within that. And I think that piece that Food, Farm and Countryside Commission bore to light within that was, yeah, the inability to create buildings for new entrants or to refit existing buildings for people to actually live in. So there's the planning side of it. There's also the potential impact in terms of the choices that you can make in terms of how you manage your land and the I suppose the principal purpose of what you use that for as well. I know for a fact where I'm from, we don't actually have any national parks at this point in time, and there was a very contentious debate probably about 10, 15 years ago about bringing in a new national park in the Mourne, which is, I suppose, a mountain range in the south of Northern Ireland. It got toxic, I suppose, in terms of the fear of a national park authority telling farmers what they could and couldn't do on land that they own. I think that's an element of it too. And ultimately, that proposal never actually came to fruition as well. So I think there's the real and
Phil,
then there's
just to interrupt, farmers are told what to do through government policy. I mean, we've discussed this ad nauseum, haven't we? The way that over the last 70 or 80 years, farmers have been directed to farm in a particular way. And now we're transforming that because we have a different understanding of the needs from the countryside. And government public policy is trying to change that. So national parks in that way are no different. In what way do you have a sense of how much more stringent it is to live under the conditions in a national park?
I would say realistically, looking at it, and if you're looking at it from the perspective of an impact on how you manage land with a biodiversity focus, say, for example, the data demonstrates that nature is actually, in many cases in England, doing worse within national parks than it is outside of them. And that would bring to light an argument of whether there's actually restrictions there at all. So,
which is crazy. And why is that?
Well, one of the things within this about the purpose of a national park, it's quite interesting. In the UK, national parks are a different type of designation than what you have in Europe and the United States, for example. In Europe and the USA, and I suppose kind of with that kind of focus on what national parks are, it's a pristine, unmodified natural landscape. So you're looking at the likes of Yellowstone National Park, things like that. Whereas in the UK, it's a semi-natural landscape where farming is deeply embedded within that. And there's more of a focus on agriculture per se over, I would say, potentially other objectives within that. That argument could be made. And one of the things within this, we've obviously had in England a review of national parks, how the governance of those could be changed to make them work more effectively for the people who live there, but also the objectives that they're trying to meet within that. And one of the key kind of proposals coming out from this, so this was the Glover review, was that national landscapes should have a renewed mission, and that should be partly to recover and enhance nature, and that there should be a new body brought into place known as the National Landscape Service, which would ultimately deliver that function. So it's interesting. I think it's worth reminding ourselves that we have a slightly different approach to national parks than other parts of the world.
It was interesting as well, because part of that Glover review, part of that response was that it's about national parks delivering more than simply beauty. And it's recognising that farms have a role not only in producing food, but also in reducing carbon emissions and sequestering carbon, that national parks need to play their role in meeting housing demand. And part of that, of course, is, you know, those working and living in those landscapes and helping with, you know, technology and social shift, recognizing that national parks aren't about preserving things in aspic. They're about trying to maintain something that is beautiful and working in a modern context, which means that these landscapes will exist into the future. And as we are facing, as we know, this ecological crisis, this ecological emergency, that means that everybody, wherever they are, needs to be doing things differently, whether they're in a national park or elsewhere, in order to make sure that that landscape, that the nation is sort of functioning and able to survive in the future.
Yeah, it's a very good point. And it's a bit of a cliche, but the term the jewels in the crown are used quite a lot to kind of outline the importance of designated landscapes, designated, I suppose, protected sites, all those sorts of things. And these should be the areas that really demonstrate to the rest, I suppose, demonstrate how the rest of the countryside could be managed to deliver a range of different objectives all at the same time. And there's so much potential within national parks as well, just in terms of localized governance, for example, the opportunity to work within a national framework to deliver local priorities and within a predefined landscape. It's pretty significant. And I think whenever you're looking at the situation in Scotland, where you have a not insignificant amount of investment going into a place to deliver all of these things, it's reframing the opportunity that could be there for landowners from having from managing and working within a national park as well, or in one of those landscapes, because quite often it's viewed in terms of the restriction on current activities, but there's also the massive opportunity within that as well. It's easy to say, but in terms of what's happening in Scotland and the Cairngorms in particular, there has been contention in that landscape, but that level of investment isn't something to be sniffed at, I would say.
No, it really isn't. And I'm interested in a way, when I've spoken to people within the National Parks Authority and within national parks themselves, I've generally been very impressed. I mean, I guess the people I'm talking to are people who have a more of a direct link to farming, who have a better understanding of farming in the landscape. But I have been impressed by what they know and what they're trying to achieve and the way that they talk about things and the way that they have a recognition and understanding of some of the challenges that are very real within those landscapes. And I wonder if part of this is about how that national policy or these overarching national frameworks get communicated out to people lower down that food chain, and also how different authorities in different places try and deal with similar issues. So there's probably an awful lot of inconsistency. And I think this is something that the Food Farming and Countryside Commission was alluding to, that there are places, there are national parks authorities, there are councils working within those national park areas who are really creative, who are really positive. If a farmer's coming to them and saying, I want to do this, then either they try and, you know, they bend over backwards to make sure that it can happen, or if it can't, then they work with that farmer to make sure that the plans are adapted and developed in a way which, you know, which works, but, you know, delivers from both perspectives, from the national park perspective and for the farm business itself. But then there are others where you find councils that simply say no. And certainly my experience of moving around, just as a resident, moving around the UK, is that there is an incredibly wide variety of understanding, of knowledge, of experience, and frankly, of compassion, is that word again, when working with people who are trying to live and run their businesses in these areas.
It's that, not necessarily a trade-off, but potential tension between allowing for autonomy and creativity and to do something that is bespoke and suitable for place. And that's a really, really crucial concept within land use, because no two areas of land are the same. No two regions or locations are going to have the exact same challenges, the exact same types of opportunities. And there needs to be flexibility to capitalize on those. But then there's a risk, just I suppose in terms of organizations in general, that you can have some that are really, really leading the way and others that are laggards in a respect too. And I don't have any answers in terms of governance structure which has an appropriate balance between the two of them. But I agree that there is something that needs to communicate what the nation so-called kind of needs from land management and from these landscapes in particular, and almost sets the rules of the game and the operating structure of which they work within and the objectives that they're trying to meet on a broad scale. But there's an element of freedom in how you do those and how you deliver those outcomes. But you're not just going off, I suppose, willy-nilly without a clear plan in place. And I think one of the things that we've been talking about within this is, the role of support and different types of schemes and things like that. And DEFRA have rolled out the Farming and Protected Landscape Scheme, which I suppose was a pot of funding which was given to national parks to try and deliver objectives that were local to them, but also fitted in with what the government wanted as well. And you hear some very good examples of how those have been tailored to really deliver really ambitious and really, really brilliant stuff in some national parks. And then in others, you hear that the scheme hasn't been utilised to its full effect. So I think that's an example of, I suppose, the challenge that you outlined earlier, operating in practice.
And it's interesting, actually, within the farming and protected landscapes, I was the chair of the panel in the Cranbourne Chase area of outstanding natural beauty, as it was then National Landscape Now, for a couple of years. And I think there is a degree to which panels are, they're dependent on the sort of projects that come forward. And, you know, we were very fortunate. We had a fantastic project officer who was able to work very closely with the farmers who were interested in making applications, but it was still dependent on, you know, which farmers were wanting to make applications and what those were for. And certainly in the early days, I think that really we were looking at projects that were glorified set aside to one extent or another. And over time, they became better integrated, more regenerative. And there's an interview actually on 8.9 in the 8.9 TV section. You probably have to go back 3 or 4 months, maybe 2 or 3 months, with Tom Munro, who runs the farming and protected landscapes aspect of the Dorset National Landscape. He was actually an architect in setting up the farming and protected landscapes scheme in the first place. And I, you know, what he had to say was very interesting. It's worth, you know, sort of searching back and finding that interview. And I guess you mentioned governance and different governance structures. And I wonder whether it comes down to different governance structures, because there are a whole range of different ways of approaching governance. And often you can be effective in any one of those. But it's about communication. It's about the mentoring and the training and the experience that gets built up. And I guess we just really need to move from a position where somebody goes to a farmer, you know, who's got an idea, goes to the council, gets to a council officer, and instead of that council officer saying, "Oh," sucking their teeth and kind of saying, "Well, I'm not sure about that. That's not gonna wash in a national park." We really need to get to a place where that council officer is saying, "Okay, I understand what you want to do. How can we make this happen?" And that's either by saying, "What you've got is fantastic," or it's by saying, "We're going to have to modify this, but we're going to work with you. We're going to provide that support for you to make sure that that modification is something that works for you as well as working for us."
So now we're going into the realm of business management. So how much of that is kind of cultural within an organization where it's relatively codified and standardized across all members of staff, or how much of it is individuals and the individuals that you work with? It's probably a little bit of both, that certain organizations hire certain types of people, or in your experience, what do you think? Because sometimes you get that whenever you're trying to get something done with one organization, and you can have a completely different experience depending on the person that you're dealing with.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it just comes down to training and mentoring and constantly sort of checking back and looking at this. And really, it comes down to good management, doesn't it? An organization is only ever as good as its managers. And if those managers are effectively Jobsworth, then it's going to be a problem. Whereas if you've got a can-do attitude running, you know, in a vein from the top to the bottom of that organization, where there is, an empowering management regime in place rather than one that's just setting up there, you know, where people feel they're just being tripped up or the managers are trying to catch them out on a regular basis, you know, that's where we've got to move to, isn't it? Something which is positive, and that's what generally gets results. If people are happy in their work, then they generally try and make other people happy.
Yeah, and then this brings us into the question of whether national parks and national parks authorities are being funded at the at the right level and the right scale so that people are fully equipped and able to do their jobs and to do it well. And you see that, I suppose, through recent decades, like a lot of arm's length bodies, national parks have been facing quite significant cuts. And as a result of that, they're probably unable to provide that level of service and that probably like that quite important cultural element of supporting people within landscapes. So again, it comes back to that point around looking at the opportunities within land, looking at the opportunities within land use, looking at the important role that national parks can play, not just in terms of what they can deliver in their own right, but what they can demonstrate in terms of how the rest of the country can be managed to deliver all these different things. And then, putting your money where your mouth is, which is an easier argument to make than to get done.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we need to be clear that living in a national park, living in that sort of, you know, landscape, unique, beautiful place, it's a privilege. And working and farming in that place is a privilege. And the place that we need to get to is that the farmers who are working there, the farm businesses, that people aren't fearful of what they're trying to achieve, aren't fearful fearful of trying to grow what they're doing, to change what they're doing, and that they can have a constructive relationship with national parks. Look, I think we need to come to a conclusion. This conversation clearly isn't going to go away, and I'm sure that we're going to come back to it again in the future. I'd like to thank Rachel Jones from Sustain once again. I've been Finlow Castain. Bye for now.
And I've been Phil Carson. Goodbye.